Hey everyone, it's Charlene. Welcome back to season 2, episode 2 of Golden Hour. We have a great episode for you today. So let me tell you about how I discovered today's guest. I was listening to my Spotify Discover playlist, and all of a sudden I came across this song that kind of stopped me in my tracks. It had these really unique processed drums and this really great guitar solo, and it just sent me into a daydream of my teenage years learning how to drive in Arizona, falling in love with music. So I looked up who the artist was. It was an artist by the name of Supernova. And as soon as I read more about her, I knew I had to have her on the show. Supernova, aka Ellie Kim, is a Korean-American transgender artist and a force of nature. She writes, shreds the guitar, produces, mixes, and masters all of her own music. Her highly personal songs aim to put queer folks of color front and center, detail the experience of her own transition, and celebrate the complexity of being many different things all at the same time. Her second album, American Queers, is one of the all-time best-selling transgender albums on Bandcamp. And, fun fact, she is a whole doctor. In a past life, she went to medical school and earned her MD before deciding to become a rock star, a decision I wholeheartedly support. Not only that, but she once advocated for her hospital to stop surgery on babies who were born intersex, which is a condition in which a person is born with an anatomy outside of the male-female binary. We get into that and so much more. Here's a clip of Supernova's song, Serotonin Serenade. So without further ado, let's get started. I want to hear about your childhood and some of your first memories of music. And was there anything that like first sucked you in and made you go, oh, this is actually something that interests me?
Yeah, no, I've always played music in some capacity for like, you know, as long as I can remember. I played guitar since I was like 8 or 9, like pretty young. I started like playing like pop punk music.
Yes.
Yeah, I was into like, you know, whatever, you know, was I guess popular at the time, you know, like, you know, I like Green Day, Blink-182, Weezer, stuff like that. And I played in like some bands, you know, with friends growing up. And then, I went to school, studied jazz guitar in college. I got into jazz and just played in like every band, like a genre you could imagine, like, you know, rock, hip hop, R&B, jazz, you know, blues, like funk, everything. And so like, it was just kind of like a guitarist.
Did you ever take formal piano lessons like me, or how did you discover guitar?
Yes, actually.
at this point, it's like kind of understood.
Yeah, it's like assumed.
Anyone that comes
like,
in here has a background in classical piano.
It's like piano or violin. My parents, like most Asian parents, they had me, well, I guess they technically had me start on violin when I was really young, but I was like too, they started me so young, they said like I was too small to hold a violin.
Oh! Wait, were you like out of the womb?
I was like 4 or 5 years old. They like wanted to start me young, and they're like, let's wait. And so
you are Juilliard bound.
Yeah.
And we're gonna make sure that
I know. And then they had me do piano, which I hated like most people. I quit as soon as they let me. Mm. But I learned like almost nothing. I hated it. I didn't really try.
Yeah.
But I started guitar after that because it was like more fun. And like my mom had a guitar like in her closet, like that she brought from Korea.
What kind of guitar was it?
It was like this like nylon string classical guitar.
Yeah.
Because like my parents are Korean.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They're Korean immigrants. And like in South Korea, like the nylon string guitar was really popular. So like most people played like nylon, mm-hmm. like, you know, America, most people, if they have an acoustic guitar, it's steel string.
Yeah.
And like in Korea it was like nylon string. So anyways, yeah, but anyways, for me it was Brain Stew by Green Day was
nice.
The first song. And yeah, it was like the first thing I could do kind of well. I someone showed me I could just do it. I wasn't really good at almost anything else growing up. Like, I wasn't good at school. I wasn't good at sports. I wasn't good at piano. I wasn't good at all those things. Yeah. So I was like, oh, it was the first thing I was like kind of good at.
Yeah. Tell me more about that journey and like how did that parlay into you writing your own songs?
Yeah, I honestly did not write my own songs till I started Supernova for, I guess it's 5 years ago now. I was always just a guitarist. I tell people it's like definitely like a combination of things of like definitely internalized racism. I grew up in the Midwest where I was like the only Asian almost everywhere I went.
Where in the Midwest?
I grew up in a suburb of Chicago.
Okay.
So yeah. And so it's like, you know, it's, you know, I love Chicago and like the Chicago music scene with all my heart, but like outside of Chicago, it's basically like the South without the good food. Like, it's just like very awfully conservative and just like, you know, like I haven't been back to that outside of Chicago in a long time, but like the last time I went, it was just like Trump flags everywhere. And like, you know, I got bullied all the time for being Asian, all these other things. This is even before I came out, you know?
Yeah.
I just like, and also just growing up, like, you know, I'm sure you remember, like we didn't have a ton of Asian pop musicians out there. I mean, I'm sure they existed, but you know, they just weren't accessible to me when I was a kid. And certainly no queer Asian pop musicians. Again, you know, like I'm sure they existed, but like they were just not elevated and they weren't accessible to me. I just like had this like subconscious idea that like as people who look like me don't get to do that, you know, don't get to sing, don't get to be like front of stage, you know. So that's why I love to play guitar and I love music, and so I kept doing that, and it wasn't until later that I started to write.
How did your family respond to you having more and more of an affinity to this particular path, and how did they react to it?
So when I was younger, they weren't like happy about it, but I'm like, it wasn't as bad as some of my friends I knew. Like, they saw it as like, I could put this on my college resume type of thing.
Yeah, so, like, truly that's the means to everything.
Right, exactly. So like they kind of left me alone, thank God. I mean, I had some friends who literally, I mean, it's awful, you know, like Asian friends, I mean, who like, you know, if they were into art, like their parents would literally like throw away their pencils and markers so they couldn't draw, like, you know, just like, so they like could not do it. And, you know, like, thankfully I didn't have that. But yeah, they definitely weren't happy about it. I majored in music. Again, this kind of ties in with the medical school part. Like, I convinced them that I could do it because I was like, oh, it'll help me get into medical school, which is true. It like art, medical school is like arts degrees. And so I was pre-med and I was jazz guitar major. So I was doing pre-med classes on top of the jazz stuff. So like when people were doing like free electives and stuff, I was doing like biochemistry and like organic chemistry and stuff. And at first it was kind of just like a cover so that my parents would get off my back, you know, type of thing. But then, yeah, like for a variety of reasons, I ended up going to medical school.
Yeah. Did you have an authentic interest in it, or were you still following the thread of like?
I think part of me, there was definitely some part of me that was like, you know, I wanted to do a job that was meaningful and that like could help people for sure. But like looking back in retrospect, like it was definitely, again, like a couple of those things like internalized racism. Like even still then I was like, well, people who look like me don't get to make music, you know? Pop music very often, and like especially because like at that time I was starting to realize that I was queer, and so I was like, I'm eventually going to come out. And like I had so much internalized transphobia at the time, you know, I don't believe this anymore, but at the time I was like, well, you know, like trans women are like the bottom rung of society, so like I have to do something like magnanimous to just to like earn people's basic respect, right?
Absolutely.
And so I was like, you know, being a doctor would be like, would kind of solve that problem. Yeah, and then like the parental pressure.
So much to go through at the same time.
Right, exactly. And then like, yeah, I had my parents who were like, who this whole time were expecting me to go to medical school. And so it was like, it would just like solve everything at the time. I was like, it'll solve everything. Like, I don't have to deal with the race stuff. I don't deal with the queer stuff. It'll solve the queer stuff. It'll make my parents happy. And so, yeah, and that's eventually when I went. And, you know, before I realized that I didn't want to do that anymore. But
So. What was the field that you were studying?
So in medical school, at least in America, it's all just one. Gotcha, and then afterwards, you like pick a specialty. So it's like in America, there's like two parts. There's like 4 years of medical school where you get your MD.
Yeah.
And then there's like a residency part where, so like if you graduate the 4 years, you have an MD, you're technically a doctor. But then after that, you have to do a 3 to 5 year residency, which is like an internship where you, after that, you get your license where you can practice independently.
Yeah.
So I did the first part. So I graduated. I'm technically a medical doctor. Like I have MD after my name.
You have an MD. I saw that.
Yeah. But I can't legally practice medicine unless I did at least 1 year of a residency, which which I didn't do. I don't plan on doing. Yeah. So I can't, don't ask me to prescribe you anything. I can't. I'm sorry. But yeah, so...
Yeah. I mean, I was in my research about you, I was reading about how there was a quote that you said in one of your interviews where you were like, it would have been really important at some level for me to be a visibly trans doctor as well. And right. like, I regret not being that, but I also know that this is really important for me to do mm-hmm. music as far as like embracing what my true identity as an artist is. And I just want to say how impressed I am and how brave it is for you to choose a career in the arts after going so far down this road of institution.
Yeah.
And it's also incredibly badass how you played a big part in your hospital's correcting its policy to change intersex babies' genitalia at birth.
Yeah, thank you. I think a lot of people get, not just trans people or Asian people, like get caught up in any field really that they realize that they don't actually care about. They're pushed by their family or their parents or society, or like, you know, whatever sense of like they felt they need to do it to prove their self-worth, like me. But like that, it's like, yeah, it's life is short. It's never too late to do something different, and you should do what you want to do with your life as much as you are possible, as much as you can. And I think being trans helped that. Cause like once I came out, mm-hmm. like once you get over that hump of like, I'm already living this life that like 90% of the world considers to be like ridiculously like wrong, you know, that like, I'm like, well, I already got over that. I was like, why would I care about anything else anyone else thought about me? Right. You know? Yeah. So I was like, yeah, I'm doing something weird, but I'm like, my whole life is like weird to most people, you know? So it was like, it made things relatively easier. Oh yeah. So the intersex stuff. So yeah, it was a combination of things, you know, it was kind of in the right place at the right time. After I graduated medical school, like I needed a day job. I have a lot of student loan debt, the downside of this path. Oh. And so I had a day job. I wasn't obviously making enough money for music, which is really hard to do. But I was working at a really great place, like a LGBTQ health center, mm-hmm. Where actually I worked as a student too, where we saw like trans kids who came for hormones and puberty blockers and stuff. I just so happened to be in a very specific position that I was able to kind of leverage people I knew, and like the relative privilege I had as like this rare combination of like, I have medical expertise, I have a medical degree, I'm working at a major children's hospital, and like, I don't give a shit about my career. So like, you know, most people are afraid to speak up. Yeah. Most people are like, oh, is this going to come back to haunt me? Like, who do I know it's going to mess up? I'm like, well, I don't really have to worry about that. Cause like worst case scenario, whatever, I'll get fired. Like I didn't really want to do this. Like I'll find something else, you know.
Go out in a blaze of glory as a rock star.
Yeah. Like it would have been bad timing because it would have been the middle of the pandemic and, you know, I would have really struggled financially, but like I would have found something, you know. I also had my partner who was working at the time. So like, you know, like I had some semblance of a safety net. But yeah, it was like, I mean, I don't want to take too much credit. Obviously, a lot of it is the work of the intersex activists who were in Chicago, across the country, you know, Cypherwall, Pigeon Pergonis, like they really led the moment. I only know about it because of people like that. They were in Chicago, mm-hmm. And connected me to it. But yeah, it is a very big ongoing struggle in the LGBTQ+ community that not as many people know about. And it's exactly that, because a lot of people who are still doing these surgeries, they like to obfuscate it. They're like, oh, it's complicated. You don't understand. You have to be a doctor to understand. It's very complex. It's not complex at all. And so because I could say like, I am a doctor, I know, I understand it's not complex, you know, and I could say that. And a lot of people who are in the community, or I'm sorry, in the medical community weren't willing to say that or didn't know. And the people outside the community, like, you know, if you're not knowledgeable about that issue, like might just say like, oh yeah, you're right. Maybe I wouldn't know because I'm not a doctor. I feel lucky more than anything to have been able to be a part of it in a position to help.
Yeah. As an advocate and as a queer person, I think your voice uniquely matters in this issue. And I was really intrigued by this aspect of your story, because it's true that we might not know very many intersex people because their gender gets assigned at birth without their consent.
Right.
And so your part in this hopefully ensures that there's more consent involved and that they can make decisions for themselves once they come to terms with what their gender identity feels true to them. Yeah.
Yeah, it's exactly that. That's part of the issue, is that not only were a lot of these surgeries were done not just without their consent, but without their knowledge.
Yeah.
And up until recently, families were encouraged to lie to their kids and say, like, you didn't have this surgery, like basically gaslight their own children. And be like, and they later on have all these issues because these are high risk, high complications. It's like people are like, make it sound like, oh yeah, we'll fix your baby's genital, which already has been fucked up. But like, they're not. They're very, very high risk, high complication surgeries. A lot of people have, you know, everything from numbness and like mm-hmm. loss of sensation to inability to orgasm, major depression, like hormonal issues, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All just so their bodies can look more normal, like a little bit more normal. Like they don't, you know, so a lot of people didn't know. Some people find out much later in adulthood that they're intersex. A lot of people, because a lot of people's intersex conditions are silent too. You can be intersex and have no symptoms and look, you know, like a non-intersex person. A lot of people actually. That's definitely part of it too. And yeah, there's a lot of layers to it. I'm a gender fluid, glorious jubilee. I trust myself a little differently. I don't care whatever body you're born, wear your horns.
Something that really stuck out to me while listening to your music is how many words like splendor and glorious and jubilee you yeah. have in your work. And it's so uplifting. And I love music for its unique ability to take back power from those who have taken it from you, especially in marginalized communities. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if that's a conscious choice or if that's something that kind of came out subconsciously while you were beginning to write your first songs as Supernova.
It was a little bit of both, but it was definitely a little conscious, you know, like at the time, I wanted to write songs that were explicitly queer, you know, like that had the words in it. Like there was so much, and again, it's better now, but like, you know, before in the times before, like, you know, when you did get queer music, it was like very implied or it was very like subtle. And it was like, you kind of had to read between the lines.
Yeah. It's like,
you know?
We're cool for the summer. What does
right.
that mean?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like, you know, very vague pronouns and it's yeah. just like, you know, like you had to like read about it on Wikipedia or whatever. And like, so yeah, I wanted music that was just like very unapologetically queer. You know, it's like, I was very inspired by, you know, people who used music, not just to make, you know, pretty songs and melodies, but to like, you know, impact some semblance of social change. And, you know, where I grew up in Chicago, you know, it's like Mavis Staples and the Staples Singers, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, so many other great artists who use their art to further, you know, racial justice or social justice causes. And so I was kind of inspired by that and kind of wanted to work some of that into my music. And then also, you know, just like when you're at the time, you know, like I was just coming out, or like earlier, like baby trans, I guess you could say. And, you know, you're like inherently more like blunt or blatant with those things when you come out, and most people like kind of like, you know, it becomes more subtle over time, but yeah, it was a little bit of both. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I read that you wrote Serotonin Serenade during a major depression that you
yeah.
had. And yeah, as much as you feel comfortable sharing, I'd be curious to hear about that. And also about how specifically those songs were born from your coming out period and your transition.
Yeah, I wrote that during like, you know, really, really, really bad depressive episode. You know, depression is different for everybody, obviously. But my experience with it was like how I describe it. It's like you have like a tank of good feelings, like in your brain or whatever. And like whenever something positive happens, like you pull a lever and like a little bit of good feeling comes out. Like, you know, you see your friend on the sidewalk and like a little bit of good feeling comes out. Like you have a nice meal or like something really great happens. Like you pull the lever and like good feelings come out and you feel good. And for me, it was like, in addition to like the sadness and like low energy and all that stuff, it was like anything that I did, like I would just pull the lever and like, it's just like cobwebs, like nothing. I'd feel like nothing. I would feel like not good about anything, nothing that like used to make me feel good. It was definitely a time early when I was coming out and, you know, it's like, I think most trans people today, like, you know, have some sort of depression or hard times when they first come out and transition. I was luckier than most. I had a partner who was very supportive. I had friends, but like, you know, obviously my family wasn't very supportive. It was a tough time, but that song was like the first one of like the rare bright moments where I could like sit down and like play music and I like started to feel good again. And like I originally tried to write it like kind of like hazy and floaty to like kind of like how I felt, like, which is like very disconnected from the world. Like I felt like I was just like not here, I guess. And but then it ended up sounding kind of beautiful and it actually made me feel better. And still does to this day, honestly.
Yeah, I read that song came out really quickly too.
Yeah, well, that was the last one I wrote for that album, American Queers. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like tacked on at the end. I was mm-hmm. like, oh, this is good. I should put this on. And it ended up being the most popular song.
I know. I know. It's really amazing to see that something that took such a short amount of time to write and almost sort of like came through you is the one that is your most listened to song on Spotify. And I hope it's opened so many doors for you with regard to your journey and talking about all this stuff, because it's so important. So yeah, I'd love to know about what your process is like as somebody who drives the ship in every single aspect of the process. Like, you mix and master all your own stuff too.
Yeah, I do.
Pretty incredible.
Thank you. It's a lot of work, but it's a lot of fun too. Yeah. And there's a lot of reasons to not a mixture and master your music too. Actually, I think most people recommend you don't. I did it mostly out of necessity, because I didn't have the money to pay someone to record or mix or master me at the time. And so I was like, rather than like waiting to get the money, I'd rather just learn to do it myself. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's like, you know, I guess the blessing, I went to medical school. I was like, well, I mean, I went through 4 years of medical school. I think I could figure out, you know,
EQs.
I was like, so, you know, it's, and then especially, I think more importantly, is like nowadays you can do that, right? Like when I was growing up, like you, I don't want to say you couldn't, but it was much, much harder because like, you know, technology was so much more expensive. Studios were inaccessible. You didn't have like YouTube. Now, like, I went to YouTube University to learn everything I know about mixing and mastering.
Yeah,
there's so much
on
the internet for free, or things that you can like buy for relatively cheap.
I am kind of the school of thought that once I started to regard songwriting and creativity as more of like a spiritual practice for myself, it gave me a lot of freedom to make the work that I wanted and not think about the outcome. And just allow it to be something that becomes a devotional element of my life. And I'm curious about how you view creativity, if you think that it's something that is more subconscious or spiritual.
So for me, definitely more subconscious.
Yeah.
So there's like two aspects of that. Like one, I kind of like agree with you in that like for me, it's like kind of spiritual, like even more so in that like leaning into that, like, you know, my mom was like very strict Catholic, and you know, so I was raised in like the church or whatever. I'm not Catholic anymore.
That's okay.
Yeah, for the record, I mean, it's okay if you are, but so like for me, you know, like music definitely fulfilled like part of that, my life that was like fulfilled by spirituality, where like, you know, you get the same kind of like sense of like, you know, leaving your body, you're like your connection to the world, or you can kind of just like zone out and you feel like you're everywhere and nowhere at the same time. And, you know, something that a lot of people get from religion or being in a church. And for me, music was that, definitely, like just listening to music. And then eventually when I found music community, you know, like the same kind of like human community too. And that just like indescribable like spiritualness of listening to music and enjoying music or playing music. Mm-hmm. And so definitely when I write, I always say like, my hands are smarter than my brain. Like I always envy people who can sit down and be like, I want to write a song about X and I want to be happy and I want to do this. And like, I could never done that. Like, and I don't know if I'll ever be able to do that. Like, I definitely kind of sit down and like need just like random things to like trigger and like press.
Yeah.
And then that'll spark an idea. And then like, I almost feel like it's like they're floating in the air.
Yeah.
I just like channel them. Like, I didn't come up with them. They were just like floating in the ethos.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So yeah, for me, it's definitely subconscious. Obviously you make some conscious choices, you know, mm-hmm. but in terms of like idea generation and like inspiration, and for me, it's 100% subconscious.
Yeah. That's so inspiring to hear. I love this idea that your hands are smarter than your brain, and the way that your body intelligence tells mm-hmm. you the type of song to make can dictate how you're feeling, or like tell you how you're feeling about something after the fact.
Totally. Yeah. I totally, agree with that. I think for sure, even, like music and lyrics, like even like the lyrics, which I think a lot of other people write more consciously. Like mm-hmm. I even write lyrics, like I feel like pretty subconsciously, and it won't be till like months later that I can like look back and be like, oh, that's where that came from. You know,
yes.
It was like, oh, that's what I was writing about. Like when I'm writing it, I'm like, I don't know where this is. I'm like a lot of time, most of the time, I'm like, I don't know what this is about. And then it's not until later that I can kind of see like, it's almost like, you know, it's almost like a therapist, you know, like when you tell someone something and then when the act of saying it out loud, you can kind of like pick it apart easier. It's like this kind of same thing with like writing lyrics where you're like, you like get it down and then you're like, you can look at it from like a distance and be like, oh, that's what that meant, you know?
Yeah. Like I wasn't ready to say that to myself.
Right.
But yeah
exactly.
Now I am. Do you have any specific songs like that where you can look back on now and be like, oh, I know what that was about now, but at the time I didn't know?
Yeah. mean, honestly, most of them. Like almost all of them. Yeah. Like there's a song on my first album called Burn, you know, and it's like, you know, it seems very obvious now, but at the time I was like, oh, just like interesting words. And I look back, I'm like, oh, it's obviously about like my transition. This song is about like kind of like burning like your old memories and like moving past like to new things and like, yeah. And so like, again, it seems obvious now, but at the time it's like about like burning my old identity or like my old life or like the old connections I had to like these things I didn't, that weren't really actually meaningful to me.
God, that is so fascinating. It's so interesting how you're kind of like talking to your future self.
Yeah. In a way. Yeah. That's like the awesome thing about music or arts in general, right? Where it's just like, it can transcend the artist, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
As someone who does it all yourself, how do you trust your instincts and not endlessly go back and like edit things?
Mm-hmm.
How do you know when something's done and how do you have the self-discipline to finish a project within a certain amount of time?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, first of all, I mean, I'll say like definitely there's something you can't get producing yourself that you can with collaborations, you know? So it's like, I'm definitely not someone who's like, oh, like everyone should produce themselves and like, or that it's better or worse. But it's just like anything like practice. You just have to like kind of do it over and over and over again. And then also like for most people, I feel like, you know, I hear that from a lot of producers, like they're like, oh, like I feel like who've never produced their own stuff. They're like, oh, I feel like, you know, I need someone's opinion. I wouldn't trust my own ears. But like, you've been listening to music your entire life, right? Mm-hmm. For years, decades, potentially, you know, depending on how old you are. And like, you know what you like and you know what sounds good to you. So if it sounds good to you, it's good. You know what I mean? So it's like, and that's, if you think about it in context, like you're never going to make anything, no matter who you work with, who you collaborate with, it's going to sound good to everybody. So you should always strive to make things that sound good to you.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you do that more and more, you just trust yourself more and more, you'll hone in how to get what you like faster. So, you know, like this idea that like someone out there has more experience and can tell you what sounds good, that's false, right? Like only you know what sounds good to you and the people who's going to like your music, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want to connect with people who like what you like, what sounds good to your ears. So in that sense, it's almost like a fail safe, right? It's almost like in that sense, like better because like you're only getting the people who hear like you hear, right?
Right, right.
So there's that. The other side is, of course, it is agony and it is definitely, you know, like you sometimes edit things forever and ever, but I think because I record, mix, and master, like I think I know that there's a ticking time, like clock in the back of my head. Like at some point, I will not be able to hear this in any objective fashion. So like I kind of have to move a little quickly because I'm like, I only have like 50 listens before like I completely have lost what this sounds like.
Such good advice.
Yeah. But that being said, you know, like I think it's also reassuring to hear like when I watch videos of like famous producers and famous engineers who say the same, who do collaborate, who say the same exact things of like hit records that like, I'm like, this song is amazing. And they're like, to this day, I regret not doing this in the song. And I'm like, I thought the song was perfect. And they're like, oh, I would have changed the bass line.
Or,
like,
oh my God.
And I'm like, knowing that like everyone, even like Grammy winning producers like go through that, you know, it's a little more freeing where I'm like, I'm going to regret something about this later. Like no matter how good it is, most people will probably never hear it. Most people will think it certain sounds fine. But so like those two things I keep in back of my head, I'm like, well, I'm not alone. And also no matter what I do, it's never going to be perfect. So it's like that makes it easier to move on a little bit too.
Oh, I really needed to hear that. No one knows what we're doing.
Nobody.
We're all just like muddling through it, trying to make shit that excites us and like faking it.
Yeah, totally. No, it's so true. Like, I mean, like, okay, obviously I've never been in the room with like, you know, Grammy winning producers or whatever, but like, you know, I've seen like interviews with people and like, you know, I've watched videos, like sometimes they have these like master classes or whatever with like big people who've like hit Grammy winning hits on the radio. And like, I always think in my head, I'm like, oh, well, they've been doing it so long. They must have some like system or they're doing something I'm not doing.
They've got it all figured out.
But like every time I'm always blown away. It's like, it's just a person in a room singing humming into an iPhone in a piano.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like everyone is doing kind of the same thing. Uh-huh. And like, they might get to it faster or make certain different decisions.
Yeah.
But like the process is almost the same and everyone is just like sitting in agony in their studio, humming vague melodies into an iPhone and be like, does that work? You know, and like going, doing passes and editing over and over again and trying different things and being like, oh, no, it sucks. And you know,
it's just like knowing that everything is worthy of being put into your work. And
you can,
I think the best artists are inspired by not just their medium, they typically read a lot and like watch a lot of movies and like are interested in museums and dance and whatever, because it all like goes into the soup.
Yeah, that's like, I think about that all the time, actually, about like the intersections between what seem like very different art forms. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, like I think about, you know, like the, whatever they call it, like the fin de siècle period, you know, like in France, where like all these artists, like painters, musicians, were just like, would hang out in the coffee shop and swap ideas, and you could hear the similarities, like, you know, like the, what's it, the impressionist paintings, you know, where it's very like hazy and like not very clear. And then you could hear in like Claude Debussy, who like liked the idea where like in the music do like lots of 13ths and 9ths that sounded very vague, harmonically. Mm-hmm. So like they would swap these ideas and translate it for their art form. And like, yeah, like that, those inspirations come in all the time. Like I was at, I can't remember what museum, and I actually can't even remember the artist, but it was like, he was a sculptor and he had this like big intricate glass like sculpture with like metal and glass and different pieces. And then like when they were moving into the exhibition in like 1960, whatever, like the people moving like accidentally dropped it and it like shattered down the middle.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh my God, we're so sorry. He's like, no. And he like stepped back. He's like, now it's perfect. He's like, I didn't like it before. He's like, now that that shatter, he's like, it's like perfect now, you know? And I just think about like, that's such a great analogy for like when people produce, and like so many things I've done where I'm like, oh, I fucked this up. And I'm like, wait, actually this sounds better than the original thing I was trying to do, you know?
Oh my
God. I feel like so many producers do that too. I hear this from like, you know, top Grammy winning producers, whatever, in interviews, like say the same thing where like you have to trust your instinct, where like sometimes like God intervenes or whatever, and like you can just like follow your instinct, and it's really cool.
That hits. It really hits. And it's also just a measure of not trying to control or manipulate the outcome, knowing that accidents are sometimes their own form of intervention.
Right.
Like there's beauty in the chaos, like the name that you chose for yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
I know that you have a very keen interest in space, and that was a part of choosing your name.
Yeah, I did when I was a kid, for sure. Uh-huh. And that's where I came from. I was like really into space and like stars and astronomy. And yeah, that's where I got the name supernova, because it's like a supernova is the final most energetic explosion before the death of a star. And I was like, oh, you know, it's like a nice analogy for like life, you know, giving it your all and like enjoying the beauty and the chaos. And but yeah, so yeah, I have some elements of that throughout my music. And
I want to ask you, what are some of your favorite songs of yours?
Ooh, you know, it's so funny, like I left this question because I feel like you know, when I was growing up, I feel like people would ask artists like their favorite song, and sometimes it almost felt like a race to like name the most obscure song they have. Like, no one likes this song, but I love this song.
Oh, I like track 7 on
that. Yeah, yeah, this like bonus track that no one else likes. But I once heard Stevie Wonder give an interview, and they asked him the question, what's your favorite song of your whole career? And he was like, oh, it's I Call Just to Say I Love You. And they're like, why is that your favorite song? And he's like, because it's the most popular song I've ever written. It's connected with the most people. It's brought the most joy to people's lives. And so he was like, that's what I'm here to do. And I was like, wow.
What is all else's music about?
Yeah. It's like, that's such a beautiful answer. Yeah. It's so like transparent. And like, it's not like, you know, it's okay. But you know, you do like your bonus tracks, but it's like, oh, it's a really beautiful concept, you know, that, you know, as artists, we bring joy to people's lives. And so, you know, like I love a lot of my songs, but I guess like my most popular one is Serotonin Serenade, because it's most popular. It's brought joy to a lot of people. A lot of people told me they connected with it and it's helped them through their own dark times and, you know, helped me have a career. And so, yeah, I guess I would say that one.
Ellie, this absolutely flew by. I'm so happy to have met another kindred spirit, another shredder guitar shiro. And I think this is going to be a beautiful friendship and an incredible episode. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. This was awesome.
Thank you so much again to Ellie, aka Supernova, for joining us on the show today. You can find her on Instagram at Supernova Music. And don't forget to check out her new single, Make Me Feel, available everywhere. Golden Hour is created by me and produced and edited by Dave Yim. Gabriel Hunter Chang is our production associate. You can follow us on Instagram at Golden Hour Pod and send us any thoughts on any of these episodes by emailing us at goldenhour@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time.